Members of the court, it's my honor and privilege again to reintroduce Billy Nullis from the Federal Defender's Office in Philadelphia, who will be arguing on behalf of Mr. Jackson. Thank you.
May it please the court, good morning again, Your Honors.
Good morning.
Mr. Jackson's case returns to this court after the remand for consideration of the Gardner issue by the Superior Court. And what I would like to do is reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal and then address the Gardner issue, talk about Stevenson a little bit, because I don't think we should lose track of the fact that under this court's decision in Stevenson, Mr. Jackson should be granted relief. And then if time permits, I'm hoping maybe a minute or two to talk about the Sixth Amendment, the right to counsel issue, that I think has been something overarching in this case that I would like the court not to lose track of. In terms of the Gardner issue, let me cut right to the chase. The state, for the first time at the time of the remand, created a distinction between fact and opinion and made an argument that Gardner covers factual matters but does not cover opinions that may be undisclosed to the defense. Needless to say, we've argued it several times in the past to this court. This court is familiar with Gardner. The three elements of a Gardner claim are, one, if there is something that is undisclosed, two, if it is a capital case, and three, if that undisclosed something is something that may affect the sentencing decision. Those are the elements of a Gardner claim, and that establishes a Gardner violation. Gardner does not draw a distinction between opinion and fact. In fact, Judge Cooch recognized that no other court has drawn a distinction between opinion and fact, and recognized that that distinction is actually not very consistent with Gardner itself. For example, Gardner speaks of information. It talks about matters. It quotes the dissent from the Florida Supreme Court that described evidence or opinion being not disclosed to the defense as something that establishes a violation. So it expressly uses the term opinion. And in Gardner itself, the court did not create this distinction that we respectfully submit is pretty artificial. And it's artificial in an when you try to apply it. When you look at, for example, the situation in this case, how do you apply a fact-opinion distinction to what Mr. Hurley said? What Mr. Hurley said included both factual assertions. It included assertions that clearly he indicated were based on fact. And it included things that we have submitted are classic examples of something that may affect the sentence, that a reasonable person looking at this record may say, this could affect the actual sentencing results in this case. So Mr. Hurley said, when you look at the speaker, the content, and the basis of the information, as we've described in the brief, Mr. Hurley said that in 17 years of practice, he's always been able to divorce himself from his clients, but not in this case. That's an assertion of fact. It's an assertion of fact about his practice, his mindset. He then suggested to Judge Bifferato.
Let me stop you right there. You're not suggesting that that fact is something that would qualify under Gardner, are you?
You can't break it apart. You have to look at the whole thing, and the whole thing includes factual assertions and includes Mr. Hurley's conclusions from those factual assertions.
Okay, but what I'm trying to get at is that I understand the fact-opinion distinction to be basically if there's something about perhaps the way this event took place or something about the defendant himself that was not disclosed, that certainly is a fact, okay? And it's a fact that has a bearing on the case. How many years Joe Hurley has been in practice is a fact, but how does that have any bearing on this case?
That's the string board. He begins with that, and then he makes the other assertions about Mr. Jackson being loathsome and being repulsive. He says, for example,
But you would agree that when you describe somebody's qualities, you're not giving facts, you're giving an evaluation or an opinion of those of that person's personality. Right?
He's giving an opinion which he also says is based on meeting with Mr. Jackson and the quote, I'm quoting Mr. Hurley, the explanations that Mr. Jackson gave created emotional responses in me. I found him distasteful. So what he's saying is his view of Mr. Jackson is based on private, privileged attorney-client communications. He then goes on to say, I didn't want to sit with him in the courtroom. That's how repulsive he was. I couldn't bring myself to meet him at the jail. That's how repulsive he was.
Well, I think everybody would agree that Joe Hurley had a very bad impression of the defendant and, as you say, found him repulsive. What does that do in terms of having a bearing on the judge's decision?
Well, I'll go there in just 1 second, but then he says he's guilty. He says that twice. And he says that he makes the representation he's guilty based on the private privileged attorney-client communication. And then he says he ought to die. And he says that twice to Judge Biferato. My client ought to die. And one of the things is we discussed this with Judge Cooch in the trial court in a very academic way. But just to take a step back for a minute, if a prosecutor comes to a courtroom and says, I know that the police have said that this person is guilty, but I, as the prosecutor, I've looked at the case, the man is innocent, and I'm dropping the charges.
Well, Mr. Nellis, just to make sure I have your position, is it fair to say that doctrinally your position is that what the Supreme Court had in mind in Gardner was the information, regardless of the form in which that information is expressed to the sentencing judge?
Correct, Your Honor. Correct. And what I was going to say is if a prosecutor says, I'm dropping the charges because I've done research and the man is innocent, you as a presiding judge don't forget that. 10 years later, 15 years later, you remember there was a case where the prosecutor came in and said that man was innocent. Similarly, you don't forget a defense counsel coming in and saying, my client ought to die. If you accepted the state's position, then if the Gardner PSI had included an opinion from the PSI preparer recommending the death penalty, the state's position would be equal to Gardner coming out with no relief being granted, because that would be characterized as an opinion by the PSI preparer.
Well, assuming that, just to move this along, that we would agree with your first point, there's still the rather difficult interpretive issue to whether the information has to be actually relied on by the sentencing judge or whether it simply is of a sort that could be relied on.
That's the second point, Your Honor, that I was going to get to. And Gardner does not require express reliance. And that's clear from Gardner itself. Gardner, the judge in Gardner did not rely on whatever was in the PSI to support aggravation or to rebut mitigation, or it was not mentioned orally by the judge. It was not mentioned in the judge's findings in Gardner. The Supreme Court wrote in Gardner, quote, there is no means of determining what role such confidential information played in the trial judge's sentence or if it played any role at all.
There are federal circuit courts that have held, notwithstanding your position, that express reliance is required. Is that correct?
There are two courts that have held that from the cases that have been cited by the state, but they haven't held that. That's dicta in two decisions from the circuit courts. And if you look at every one of the cases that the state has cited, none of them involved a Gardner violation. All of them were cases where the courts found there was no Gardner violation and then said, and in addition, the matter at issue is not discussed in the findings. So, for example, in Hendricks, the 11th Circuit case, there was a hearing on the Gardner claim. No evidence was put on that anything was exchanged with the judge that implicated Gardner. Then in dicta, the Court of Appeals says, and by the way, it's not included in the judge's findings. Same thing with Paradis, the 9th Circuit case. That's a case where the defendant wanted the judge to consider evidence from the co-defendant's trial, and then later that same defendant raised an argument that it was unfair for the judge to consider evidence from that co-defendant's trial. There was no Gardner violation.
Well, let's assume your position prevails on all the points you've raised so far. In Gardner itself, I think in a separate opinion, Justice Marshall said he thought a Gardner violation could never be harmless. In this particular case, the jury recommended death by a vote of 11 to 1. What's your current position with regard to whether a harmless error analysis is even possible?
I would submit initially that a harmless error analysis should not be undertaken because...
Well, no, that's different than whether it's constitutionally possible. I don't find any case that has adopted Justice Marshall's separate view. So if we assume a harmless error analysis is possible, then you could tell us why you don't think it applies in this case. But even in that situation, we would have a debate on, or we'd have to resolve what the standard of review is going to be for the harmless error analysis.
Well, classic harmless error analysis would be something that goes like this. There is constitutional error in this case. Gardner has three elements. All three are met. Undisclosed information, capital case, may have affected the sentence.
Well, that's
In
the Brecht case, that's classic. But in Brecht, they're talking about actual prejudice. So what would you suggest our standard should be, the classic application or actual prejudice?
Brecht is a standard that was created for the federal habeas courts to apply on habeas. Your Honors, as a state court, apply the classic Chapman analysis that you yourselves talked about in Ortiz and other cases. Your application of harmless error is once there is constitutional error, you look to whether that error is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And when you do that in a case such as Mr. Jackson, the analysis is, could a judge have imposed a life sentence in this case? Is there something in this record upon which a judge reasonably could have concluded life is appropriate? And there certainly is. That's not subject to debate. Judge Biferrato himself found in mitigation that Mr. Jackson was 18 years old, mentally impaired, had been abused in childhood, had a positive prognosis, and was subject to rehabilitation. A judge, on the basis of any of those factors, and especially all of them in unison, could have said the proper sentence in this case is life.
Are you suggesting that because there's mitigating evidence, a judge could have imposed life imprisonment rather than he could or could not have based on the mitigating evidence and it's being weighed against the aggravating evidence?
The question is, you don't know. That part of the classic harmless error analysis is you don't know what a judge would have done in this case objectively sitting at a sentencing proceeding.
No.
You don't have the answer to that, and therefore the error.
I'm not sure I understand that. Why would I not have known that?
Because that original sentencing was tainted, and so you don't have an actual sentence at this point that's untainted constitutionally. So the question becomes, is there something upon which a judge could have based a life sentence in this case? And there is. There's plenty in the record
but
to show
we have, that. In death penalty cases, we have to look at a universe of cases. So I think we've had 14 executions actually carried out. We have, I think, 18 people on death row. And in all of those direct appeals, we had to do a proportionality analysis. And what you find in looking at that is not simply the people that have been sentenced to death, but the people who were eligible for a death sentence and didn't receive it. And we have few, I mean, less than five, maybe three cases where the jury has recommended death, and certainly not by 11 to 1, where that was not imposed. So in this overwhelming number of cases that have gone to a penalty hearing, is it realistic to assume that based on an 11-to-1 recommendation, a death sentence would not be imposed?
11-to-1 where the jury was out for 11 hours. And in Starling, this court held that giving great deference to a jury verdict is error. And so the question again is, could a judge reasonably have voted for life in this case? In other words, had a judge voted for life in this case, would the public, would this court look at it and go, that's outrageous? That's beyond the realm of possibility. Of course not. There's plenty of mitigation in this case upon which a judge could have based a life vote. And interestingly, when we discuss the mitigation, note that Judge Biferrato found that Mr. Jackson was abused, that Mr. Jackson had mental issues, that Mr. Jackson was impaired. He found the mitigating factors that are consistent with what Mr. Hurley said. He did not find the other mitigating factors, doesn't even write them down, from a group of witnesses who testified that Mr. Jackson was warm, loving, compassionate, that this was an aberration. So even though you shouldn't, getting back to the Gardner issue, even though I submit you shouldn't tease out and try to see what the effect is on Judge Biferrato, it is interesting that Judge Biferrato could not find the mitigating factors that were directly negated by the assertions that Mr. Hurley made. Along those lines, you addressed harmless error in the Stevenson case, and you addressed it from the perspective of recusal and whether recusal was appropriate. And in this case, what you have is a case that's on all fours with Stevenson. In Stevenson, you indicated that the withholding of information upon which a defense counsel could base a recusal motion in a capital case is not subject to harmless error analysis. There's no way to put that genie back in the bottle. And in this case, there certainly was information upon which a recusal motion could have been based. Judge Cooch recognized that. The state conceded that below. Mr. O'Connell has provided an affidavit that indicates that if the Hurley transcript had not been sealed, had Judge Biferrato disclosed it, he would have made a recusal motion. And certainly an objective person looking at a set of circumstances where a defense counsel says to the judge, my client is guilty and ought to die, a lawyer would reasonably think a recusal motion is appropriate. So here's what you did in Stevenson. In Stevenson, you wrote that the failure to disclose to the defense evidence upon which a recusal motion could be based establishes an appearance of impropriety, undermines public confidence, and especially given the unique role of the sentencing judge in a capital case. That's what I was suggesting before, that you can't reconstruct what a judge untainted by the error would have done, and therefore the error cannot be deemed harmless. Given the unique role of a sentencing judge in a capital case in Delaware, where the sentencing judge actually makes the call, the failure to disclose information which would have led to a recusal motion being filed warranted reversal. And you have a similar situation here. Because this was never disclosed to the defense, Mr. O'Connell and then Mr. Foley never had the opportunity to make a recusal motion, and Judge Biferrato never had the opportunity to assess whether, subjectively, first of all, whether he should preside on the case under Lowe's. Secondly, Judge Biferrato, and there's no way now to reconstruct what Judge Biferrato would have done. So again, if we're talking about harmless error, this is a proceeding, there's nothing to apply harmless error to in this case, because you don't know what Judge Biferrato would have done subjectively with a recusal motion. Just like the circumstance in Stevenson, the very same reason why relief was warranted in Stevenson. Secondly, you don't know what Judge Biferrato would have done objectively. You don't know if Judge Biferrato would have said, well, you know, maybe I can preside, but this undermines the public's confidence in me presiding on a case where I've heard the defense lawyer say the man is guilty and the man ought to die. And so you can't reconstruct now, from a harmless error perspective, what Judge Biferrato would have done objectively with a recusal motion. I submit neither can you reconstruct now what you would have done on direct appeal had Judge Biferrato denied a recusal motion if you have a direct appeal with a judge presiding in a capital case after hearing this kind of evidence. And additionally, had the evidence been disclosed, defense counsel would have been in a position to attempt to explain, to challenge, to rebut the evidence, as we've done through the affidavit from Mr. Hurley, where he indicates that it was basically this 18-year-old impaired kids laughing during a proof positive hearing that was so pernicious to him, not the stuff about a private conversation and all of the other assertions that he made. So if you look at harmless error through the lens of Stevenson, this case is a no-brainer. If you look at it through classic constitutional analysis, because there is evidence in the record on which a judge could have voted for life, the error should not be deemed harmless. And Justice Holland, it's not a proportionality type analysis. It's trying to reconstruct what a reasonable judge could have done in this case. And since you never have that in the first place, since that was taken away by virtue of the error, it's you don't have a record to which you can apply harmless error properly. Or just to give Your Honors an example, turning to a Sixth Amendment mode of analysis, in Cook, you confronted a situation where counsel conceded guilt. Well, here you have a situation where counsel concedes death. In Cook, you wrote, the assistance of counsel is among those constitutional rights so basic to a fair trial that their denial can never be treated as harmless error. The conduct of Cook's defense attorneys was inherently prejudicial and does not require a separate showing of prejudice because Cook's counsel negated his basic trial rights and failed to function in any meaningful sense as the prosecution's adversary. That's the same thing that Mr. Hurley did here by standing up before a sentencing judge and saying, my client ought to die. Now, Chief Justice Steele and Justice Jacobs dissented in Cook on the basis that that lawyer was trying to help his client. This lawyer was not trying to help his client when he made these assertions. And I see that my time is short, but I urge Your Honors to take a look at the briefs we did post-remand. We cited to Your Honors over a dozen cases where attorneys made these, not even as bad as the assertions in this case, but similar assertions negating their client's rights, asserting that their client was guilty, saying bad things about their clients. In every one of those, the courts granted relief. In every one of those, the courts held confidence is undermined, and you can't put that genie back in the bottle as a matter of Sixth Amendment analysis. And that the state has not cited to Your Honors a single case where an attorney said anywhere near anything this bad and where relief was denied. So if you look at the case law from a Sixth Amendment perspective clearly indicates that either harmless error does not apply or confidence is undermined to the extent that relief should be granted when an error of this magnitude is inserted into the record by a defense counsel. Unless Your Honors have additional questions, I'll reserve the remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Elizabeth McFarland on behalf of the state. The state understood the court's order granting Mr. Jackson's motion for oral argument to be confined to the Gardner issue, and that is what the state intends to address.
Well, you're not going to talk about Stevenson or why you think Stevenson is distinguishable?
If the court would so direct. However, the order did say to confine it to Gardner, but if the court changes its mind, I can certainly address Stevenson. Would you like the state to begin with that?
Well, no, just work it into your remarks.
Yes, Your Honor. The state contends this is not a Gardner case at all. The state agrees that there are three elements to a Gardner claim. However, the state disagrees as to what those elements are. Undisclosed factual information, reliance in some way by the sentencing judge on that undisclosed information, and the state does agree that it is required to be in a capital case. Mr. Jackson's counsel has made a great point of saying that the cases cited by the state were all cases where no Gardner violation was found. That's, in fact, correct, because the state was unable to find any cases that granted relief under Gardner after Gardner. And one of the reasons for that is that Gardner was specifically a jury override case, which was significant to the court, and the court mentioned it several times in its decision in Gardner. Excuse me. Gardner was a case where the jury came back after 25 minutes with a recommendation of life. And the trial judge imposed a death sentence, finding no mitigation whatsoever in the case, and stated on the record that he was relying on a PSI that contained undisclosed information. The judge did not specify what that undisclosed actual factual information was, simply that he had relied upon it. And the Gardner Court, in its holding, stated that the death sentence was imposed at least in part on the basis of information which he had no opportunity to deny or rebut. By stating that due process was violated when it was imposed, at least in part, on the basis of, is it clear that the court meant reliance, at least in some part, on that information?
Well, if it's so clear, then why is there language in the Gardner opinion that suggests that as long as there could have been reliance, that would suffice to satisfy Gardner?
Well, in Gardner itself, the judge who imposed the sentence said he relied on that report.
No, I will agree that there may have been actual reliance as a factual matter in that particular case. But the U.S. Supreme Court appeared to go beyond that requirement in the language that it used in the opinion. Is that simply loose language, or does it have some significance?
The state would contend that significance was because not only did the sentencing judge state that he relied on the PSI, that was not included on review in the Florida Supreme Court, and so the reviewing court had no opportunity to look at the information upon which the judge had relied. And in fact, under Florida law, as under Delaware law, the sentencing judge is required to state on the record, or actually in written form, the basis for his sentence of death. And in this case, there was nothing in the record that showed what it was from this report that the judge had looked at, and the court looked at the fact that it was a jury override and said the only thing the judge saw that this jury did not was a PSI report. And the judge imposed death in complete contradiction to what the recommendation of the jury was. And that, I think, is why there's some language in there about it may have influenced, because the only explanation for the complete rejection of the jury's recommendation, particularly in this case, which was there were, as one dissenter in the Florida Supreme Court pointed out, there was legally sufficient mitigation, and the trial judge found none at all. The state contends that explains the language in Gardner.
Well, that's one way to interpret the language. The other is that the Supreme Court really meant that proof of actual reliance is not required. Would it be fair to say that we have an open issue of what is the appropriate interpretation of Gardner, at least on that point?
Well, the courts that have looked at Gardner have all, to the state's knowledge, gone with the reliance. And the holding in Gardner clearly says when was imposed, at least in part, on the basis.
You're talking about the two circuit court cases?
Well, yes, circuit court cases and state court cases.
And was the issue of whether actual versus possible reliance actually litigated in those cases, or was that also dictum?
In general, it was dicta because they found that there was no evidence of anything that would have influenced, or they looked at the fact that the sentencing judge explicitly stated the basis for his or her sentence, and
it was dictum.
Yes.
One last question. Is there any case post-Gardner that has distinguished between factual and opinion information other than this case?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor. It does, however, make sense to confine Gardner to factual information. That was what that case actually was interpreting, that the judge had said he relied on factual information that he had found in the PSI. And there is no reason to expand the holding of Gardner into opinions simply because the court used different wording in the rest of its opinion when clearly the issue in Gardner was what the judge said, which was what he relied on factual information in the PSI report. And Judge Cooch, on remand, looked at that very issue and noted that Gardner used the phrase factual information early in the its decision, and that the sentencing judge at issue in that case only referred to factual information in the PSI. Here, the state contends there really is no, and Judge Cooch agreed, that Mr. Hurley's remarks were clearly opinions, not fact. And he said he reached the conclusion in his mind about these things based on what he had seen at the proof positive hearing, and that Mr. Jackson's explanations did not improve upon that situation.
What was the context in which Mr. Hurley made those comments?
In the context of a hearing on a motion to withdraw, where he had earlier indicated to Judge Biferato that he would intended to withdraw depending on the DNA evidence and other factual evidence that the state would develop.
And is it fair to infer that those are comments that tend to support allowing him to withdraw from the case?
Yes. Clearly, Mr. Hurley felt strongly in this particular case, and also he had had an indication from Judge Biferato at the earlier office conference where he had expressed his intent, depending on the evidence, to withdraw in favor of the public defender's office, that Judge Biferato had suggested that Mr. Hurley really should remain on the case if he could. This was said in the context of Mr. Hurley talking to a judge that he felt was not happy with his decision to withdraw, and he clearly wanted to make sure he was granted that motion, and he certainly was.
This may not be a fair question, but in all candor, it's one that troubles me. This is Delaware. We're a small state. It's not as if we're sitting in Austin reviewing a case that was tried in East Texas or even in Albany with one tried in New York City. We know the people, the personalities of the people involved, why they might have said what they have said, but the record doesn't reflect any of that. How does one divorce that from a cold record that only reflects words that were stated and suggests little about the personality of the person who stated those words?
That is a difficulty, because clearly there are specific personalities involved in this. And however,
sometimes personalities with a capital P, yeah, as opposed to personalities with a small P.
Yes. However, in this case, we even have subsequent defense counsel, Mr. O'Connell, stating that he was glad ultimately that he had Judge Biferato in the second sentencing penalty phase, because if anyone could possibly override his earlier decision, it would be Judge Biferato himself. So that is part of the record. And what we also have here as part of the record is that Judge Biferato did, in fact, look at his situation under a motion for recusal that was on a different, based on the Talmo reversal. A motion was filed, and he did subject himself to that subjective analysis as to whether he felt he could go on with the second penalty phase. In doing that, under Los Velos, he had to look at the totality and his own subjective view, not just at the...
Is it correct that at that second sentencing hearing he found two additional mitigating circumstances that he had not found
in
the first?
Yes. And that should be noted that Mr. Jackson did, in fact, speak at the second, allocute at the second penalty hearing, and did express some remorse that he had not done earlier, and that does explain in some part Judge Biferato's finding. But he did find more in mitigation. He did find that. And the fact that he didn't find him to be compassionate and warm and kind is not surprising given the gruesome facts of this case and his subsequent attempts to have the witness against him, his friend, murdered, and his attempts to escape from prison. So when you balance that out, the fact that Judge Biferato didn't find Mr. Jackson to be warm and fuzzy is not significant. It also is significant that two juries that did not hear Mr. Hurley's remarks voted 11-1 to recommend a death sentence. Not just one, but two. 22 people.
I'm always surprised when the state makes the argument that somehow we should be influenced by what the first jury did when that was reversed on the basis that it wasn't a fair penalty hearing. If we say it's reversed because it wasn't a fair penalty hearing, why do we give weight to what the jury did?
Well, they heard the same, basically the same information. But in any case, the second penalty hearing was 11-1. And they did not hear Mr. Hurley's remarks. And they did not hear any of the tainted evidence from the first.
How would you distinguish Stevenson?
Stevenson, there was a personal interest of the judge that was clear. The judge had asked to be involved in that case.
Well, judge, those are the facts. But as you've heard your opponent say, Stevenson turns on whether the particular facts would be a basis for a recusal motion. Are the facts in this case where the defense attorney says he's guilty, he ought to die? As you know, they were sealed and then misfiled. But if they had been known, would they have been a basis for a recusal motion?
Well, they certainly could have. The state would not contend that defense counsel could not have filed a motion based on that. But the state would also contend they would not have succeeded because Judge Biferato clearly had already been subject to a different motion for recusal and had made that subjective analysis. And objectively, judges hear things about, they hear actual evidence against clients, against defendants, and there's no impropriety or appearance thereof. Judges are...
You mean they hear evidence that ultimately isn't admitted for the jury to hear?
That's correct. They hear all sorts of prior bad acts. They rule on that.
Ms. McFarland, I understood Justice Holland's question to be, could the information that was not disclosed have been a basis for a motion to recuse? And your response really... I understand it to go to whether or not if that motion had been made, it would have been denied.
Well,
let's address the first predicate question.
They could certainly, somebody could certainly have filed a motion and put that in the motion as a basis.
And it would have been a legally cognizable basis.
Presumably, almost any thing that is presented to a judge that a defense counsel would turn to be prejudicial outside could have. However, this was said in a judicial proceeding. This was not something that was said outside of a courtroom. It was not something. The issue became that it was sealed. If it hadn't been sealed, successor counsel would have known about it. And once again, I guess the question becomes, then, if it wasn't sealed, would it have been a basis? Is that
I'm, sure, I'm not under. I'm not clear on what you're arguing here. Stevenson, I mean, the critical issue or the critical analysis in Stevenson is whether the non-disclosed information would have been the basis for a recusal motion. I understand that the state agrees that Mr. Hurley's remarks, which were not disclosed, would have been the basis for a recusal motion. Isn't that dispositive?
No.
Why not?
Because here there is no appearance of impropriety at all. Here there is no personal interest of the judge. And here you can do a harmless error analysis. And in fact, this has little to do with Gardner. I mean, it's a completely different issue. But in that harmlessness, to adopt defense counsel's position would to say that Judge Biferato could have imposed life, it is not the correct way to look at that. Legally, he's...
So you're arguing that Stevenson should be interpreted as applying only in circumstances where there is both an appearance of impropriety and the judge has a personal interest.
Yes, and in this case, we also have the fact that there was a motion for recusal, and the judge did complete that subjective analysis. So we have that information here that we didn't have in Stevenson. The judge was required to do that, and as I was saying earlier, under Los v. Los, that encompasses everything, not just the basis for that particular motion. When a judge does the subjective analysis in Los v. Los, he has to look at everything, not that one fact that may have been alleged as particularly prejudicial or lending to itself to his bias. The judge has to look at everything. And at the time of the motion regarding the Talmo, clearly Judge Biferrato had already heard Mr. Hurley's statements several years earlier.
So do I understand you to be saying that that's the reason why a harmless error analysis could properly be undertaken here, because there was a recusal motion that was considered?
The state contends that certainly adds to it. Yes.
Are there any other factors here that would support a harmless error analysis?
Well, in this case, given that this was something said during a judicial proceeding and not outside the realm, there was no personal interest by the judge, that this is not really like Stevenson. This is a different situation, and therefore harmlessness can be analyzed. And what part of that harmlessness is the fact that the judge did do the subjective analysis under Los v. Los, and the overwhelming evidence in the case, the length of time between when that judge heard that statement and the second penalty hearing. 3 years is quite a significant amount of time to have elapsed from a pretrial motion hearing, and the jury finding of 11-1. All of those combined make it very clear that Judge Biferrato was not biased by any comments made by Mr. Hurley pretrial in a motion to withdraw hearing. And the state would thus contend that there, one, is no Gardner violation here. To the extent there was a Gardner violation or any other type of violation, the result is harmless in this case, given the overwhelming evidence, the jury verdict, and the judge's subjective analysis of his own impartiality. If the court has no further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, let me focus on the harmless error issue, if I may. First, the prior recusal motion did not address the comments that Mr. Hurley made. So the analysis that Judge Biferrato did was, am I either subjectively or objectively in a position to sit on the case based on the fact that I heard some testimony from a witness named Talmo that was subsequently suppressed? This court upheld that decision on appeal in part because the evidence heard at the sentencing was the same as the suppressed evidence from Mr. Talmo. In other words, Mr. Talmo testified and said the same stuff that was on that tape that was suppressed. So this court found there was no impropriety. In addition, this court said Judge Biferrato did a subjective analysis as to that evidence. And in terms of appearance of impropriety, evidence does get suppressed, and there's nothing extraordinary about it. This is extraordinary, the situation relating to Mr. Hurley. And in terms of harmless error analysis, there is no way to reconstruct what Judge Biferrato would have done, if you look at it through the lens of Stevenson, had Mr. O'Connell said, you should recuse yourself because of what Mr. Hurley said. The defendant is guilty, ought to die, coming from the mouth of the defense counsel. There's no way to determine what Judge Biferrato subjectively would have done with that, and there's no way to determine what Judge Biferrato would have done applying an objective standard with Mr. O'Connell or Mr. Foley saying, you should not preside because public confidence would be undermined with you presiding in a case where you heard these kind of things from defense counsel. Now, in terms of classic harmless error analysis. Gardner itself talks about that in the last paragraph of the Gardner opinion. One of the arguments the state of Florida made in Gardner was that the case should be remanded to the Florida Supreme Court for further analysis. And the U.S. Supreme Court wrote, that procedure, remand to the Florida Supreme Court, could not fully correct the error. For it is possible that full disclosure, followed by explanation or argument by defense counsel, would have caused the trial judge to sentence the defendant to life. Accordingly, the death sentence is vacated. And so in terms of a classic harmless error analysis, that was addressed by Gardner itself, and it was addressed also by the case, the Sixth Amendment cases that I alluded to earlier, every one of which holds that, for example, in the words of the Mississippi Supreme Court in Ferguson, you cannot retrieve an error once you have an error where counsel says that the client is guilty, not even as significant as the error in this case. Mr. Chief Justice, you made a reference to personality, and I too think, how do you pull apart personality? And it is a small community. But if you think about what Mr. Hurley's reputation is, and we'll just talk like, if there are exaggerations there, the exaggerations are in favor of the defendant. Mr. Hurley does not have a reputation of exaggerating in a way to harm his client. And so that carries some weight to say that this guy's guilty.
I understand that point,
die.
But you asked the question just a moment ago. There's no way to reconstruct what Judge Beferatu might have done on the objective end of the analysis. Well, I put it to you that Judge Beferatu may well have said, with some basis for saying so, are you kidding? Joe Hurley is the most, and certainly one of the most, hyperbolic lawyers who ever practiced in my lifetime before the Superior Court. And he made those comments in the context of wanting out of the case. I took them for what they were worth, the source and the purpose of making them. They have no effect on any careful weighing of any issue as important as whether someone should receive the death penalty or life imprisonment. Why would that be an unfair conclusion?
That is one possibility. The other possibility is Judge Beferatu could have said, hearing Joe Hurley come in and tell me this man ought to die, something Joe Hurley has never said about another capital client, having Joe Hurley say to me, on the basis of private attorney-client communications, this guy's guilty, Joe Hurley has never said that about another capital client, I don't know if I could preside in this case, and more. I don't know what the public and what the Delaware Supreme Court would say from an objective perspective were I to preside in a case with that kind of evidence. Because we don't know the answer, because it can go different ways, the error can't be deemed harmless. Not in a capital case, not where the life on the line is somebody who is 18 years old at the time of the offense. That's a mitigating factor of great weight.
Okay, I take your point. Thank you.
Mr. Chief Justice, thank you. Your Honors, thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.